Your window on the city. Cambridge 105.
You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests. But we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Today, my studio guest is Malcolm Geight, a poet, singer-songwriter, priest and academic. We'll also hear four entries, four winners and runners-up from the Rock Road Library Writing Competition, which was aimed at young people and children 16 years and under. So, hello, Malcolm. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good to be here.
So we'll be hearing writing from young writers in just a moment. Did you write when you were young?
I did, yeah. I sort of experimented, you know, as you do with many things as a teenager. I think I actually my first sense of poetry and what poetry might be, I was very young because I was lucky that my mother had great funds of poetry and just recited stuff, you know, off the top of her head.
Lovely.
And it was really great, you know. And I liked the rhythms of it. So I probably heard and remembered and learned and sort of chanted stuff, but I didn't associate it with writing. But then when I was in my sort of mid to late teens, you know, sort of 17, I sort of discovered the romantic poets, you know, and Keats and Shelley and Byron, and really got the bug and thought, you know, I want to do that. That's what I want to do, what I want to sound like.
And you grew up in Nigeria.
Yeah, that's right.
So you were aware of Nigerian writing.
Well, I wish I'd been more alert to it when I was there. As it so happens, we were in Ibadan at a time when the great Nigerian writer Shinua Achebe was a student. He was one of my father's students. My father was teaching, I mean, you might think this would be odd, he was teaching Greek and Latin in Nigeria. But actually, what my father discovered teaching Homer and Virgil, particularly Homer, these great poems from the Heroic Age, but Virgil too, where, you know, the great warrior is wondering what's become of his ancestor and is able to go down into Avernus and speak to the dead and become aware of the movement of the gods and the goddesses. You know, all of that's terribly sort of distant and theoretical if you're studying classics, you know, in a schoolroom in England. But if you're living in an animistic society, you know, Achebe famously wrote My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, and you're living in a society where those spiritual realities are coming and going all the time and where the bardic, heroic tradition is not dead. So Dad used to say that far from teaching Homer to Nigerians, the Nigerians gave Homer back to him and made him realise what that poetry was all about.
Wow, what an inspiring environment.
Yeah.
And it's so born in Nigeria. So
yeah.
You I'm calling you Malcolm, and that's the name that you go by, but you're actually given another name.
Yes,
well.
My actual first name is Ayodeji, which is a Yoruba name. My parents loved, you know, where they were and loved Yoruba culture. They weren't like, you know, there's a kind of cliched ideal of some colonial type, you know, sitting around on a veranda unaware of their surroundings.
Yes.
You know, for my parents, it was a total immersion and a delight in Africa. So Ayodeji means the second joy. Ayo means joy. And Deji means again. And it's a traditional name for a second child, which I was.
Oh, how lovely. Yeah. And do you ever use it?
I do, sort of, you know, fondly at home. Usually not the whole thing, just Ayo, the joy part of it. I sometimes sort of say myself. And I was called Ayo as a little boy. And it was only when we came back to England, you know, when I was about 10, that sort of began to be kind of a difficult name for everybody to remember and get their handle around. And I'm half Scots, so Malcolm.
Malcolm's a good Scottish name,
good Scottish
isn't it?
Name.
Well, we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. We're going to listen to your first choice of music now. This is a lovely track. Leonard Cohen, Alexandra Leaving. Why this one?
I sort of loved Leonard Cohen first time round. And then just around the time this came out, I didn't, on an album called 10 New Songs, I mean, I just it was only playing my old Leonard Cohen records. And suddenly I heard this new thing, this deep voice, this lovely high voice above it. And this poem, I think, first of all, the sheer lyrical beauty. And secondly, the context of that beauty. It's clearly the end of an affair. Alexandra is leaving. You knew this was going to happen. And it's instead of it being bitter and ego-driven, it's this resigned person saying, I was so blessed. However brief this woman's time was in my life, I had the honour of her evening, you know. the willingness and the graciousness and the kind of pathos of the letting go, whilst there's still a beauty kind of tingling in the air, it's heartbreaking and glorious.
Suddenly the night has grown colder. The God of love preparing to depart. Alexandra hoisted on his shoulder. They slip between the sentries of the heart, upheld by the simplicities of pleasure. They gain the light, they formlessly entwine.
That was Alexandra Leaving by Leonard Cohen, the first choice of music from our studio guest today on Bookmark, Malcolm Guite, or the Reverend Dr. Malcolm Guite. He's a poet, singer-songwriter, Anglican priest and academic, currently chaplain of Girton College. He's also the author of 5 books of poetry, including 3 collections, Sounding the Seasons, Poetry for the Christian Year, The Singing Bowl and Parable and Paradox. Former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams no less, has remarked that Malcolm Guite knows exactly how to use the sonnet form to powerful effect, and that his poems offer deep resources for prayer and meditation. Malcolm has also written books on Christian theology and writers that have inspired him, including C.S. Lewis and Samuel Taylor Coleridge. When he's not writing or undertaking priestly duties, he performs with the Cambridge-based rhythm and blues band Mystery Train. Mm-hmm. Well, the first question, Malcolm, I want to ask is, how on earth do you fit all that in?
Well, sort of living life to the full. Yeah, it is all pretty busy, but all of those things are, though they drain energy in one way, they give it back to you in another way. You know, they're energising things. I mean, the band, I have to say, you know, it's not like we're gigging every weekend. You know, we've all got day jobs. And sometimes you can think, oh, golly, I'm really tired. Do I want to go out and do this gig? But in fact, then you're energised. You know, people are involved in the music and again, you always kind of finish with a smile on your face. It helps that I mean, allegedly my chaplaincy job is half-time. What that actually means, it's very intensely on during the short Cambridge terms. But it does mean that for my writing, particularly, you know, my research and writing, and both my poetic writing and the prose books, I have got those vacation times, really, to get into that.
So you can get that balance. Because there was a time, wasn't there, I think in the 1990s, where you put poetry aside for several years to concentrate on your vocation.
Yeah, that's right. I did. I'd been, you know, I've always loved poetry. I don't think you can write poetry unless you also love it. I mean, you have to be a delighted and perhaps slightly envious reader of great poetry in order to want to go and do likewise. So I never gave up that reading. But when I was first ordained, you know, it was a completely new vocation. It had a very strong sense, not only of calling, but of commitment. And also, in a curious way, obviously, as a poet, you're trying, in a sense, to get past the sort of the defensive surfaces that we all have to keep ourselves going, and to write something that whispers to or awakens something more inner in a person. And there is a sense in which there's a parallel with that with the priestly thing, and the fact that you are recognised as a vicar or you're taking communion, let's say, to somebody at home, where that already happens. So in a sense, some of what I wanted to do in poetry was happening through my priestly ministry and liturgy. But I have to say, the point at which I took it up again after about 7 years was almost like a drowning man asking for water. You know, I was beginning to burn out a bit. I was doing, obviously your job is never finished. You know, you can't sort of go to sleep at night and think, oh, you know, we've taken care of everything today. So I was in danger of burnout, and I had a little sabbatical for 2 or 3 months to kind of recharge the batteries. And I thought, what do I want to do? And I suddenly thought, I want to read poetry. That's all I want to do. I just want to go back, deeply read poetry. The interesting thing was that not only rekindled my desire to write, but even though I wasn't reading, you know, necessarily explicitly religious poetry, well, there's some great religious poetry out there, but I was reading the whole range of it, it actually rekindled my faith. You know, it just opened up the depths again. So after that experience, I began to realise that these two
vocations of poet and priest really could work together in symbiosis, that I didn't have to, I wasn't robbing Peter to pay Paul if I did one and not the other, you know.
Well, obviously your faith and your poetry are very closely aligned. Yeah. Let's unravel a little bit the faith side of that. At what stage did you realise that you had a faith and that it was a Christian faith?
Yeah. Well, I was brought up in a Christian household, so it sort of started off as the kind of the air I breathed. Probably a bit stronger in my father than in my mother, but, you know, my father's a Methodist local preacher, and so I didn't sort of question it at first at all. And then naturally you do at some point. We travelled around all over the place, and at a certain point when we were living in Canada, my parents thought I might lose my English identity and everything, so they sent me off to a boarding school in England, which I found a very miserable experience. I was not a happy schoolboy. I was very homesick, but it also gave me perspective and a chance to rethink through. So, and I completely reject. I just sat down and thought, I just don't think any of this is real or makes any sense. It's just, this is not the case, you know. And so I did my best to construct a sort of completely, as I thought it, entirely rational and scientific alternative, which is of the most bleak kind, you know, we're just a bunch of stuff thrown together for no particular reason, and our consciousness is just an accidental, you know, miasma that's risen up from the random, collision of atoms, which is all very well, and you can feel very bleak, and it's very good if you're a moody adolescent, you know, you could be filled with existential angst. But actually, it doesn't account in the end for those deep experiences of joy or transcendence or even sorrow. It doesn't account for the way we're surprised by the world if we're just its natural product.
Do you not think it does? Do you not think you can have those feelings without...
I think you can have those things. I just didn't feel there was a satisfactory account. I mean, interestingly, the point at which I thought, OK, I'm not a Christian, but I'm no longer a kind of really rigid scientific atheist. I'm now an agnostic, was the point at which actually I first discovered the poetry of Keats. And it wasn't like Keats isn't a particularly religious poet and probably wasn't an Orthodox Christian in his own, he had the interesting idea that the world is a veil of soul making. But Keats's Ode to Nightingale it just completely sent shivers down my spine. It opened up depths in me I didn't even know I had. And, you know, it brings you to that brink, doesn't it? It takes you back to the natural world in the end, but it brings you to this point where you see, as in Keats's terms, you know, magic casements opening on perilous seas in fairylands forlorn. And I just didn't feel that behaviourism was a sufficiently good account. This was in days before Dawkins, really. So I had, a kind of crack opened up in the rather simplistic, concrete materialism that I had at the time. I subsequently had other experiences when I was an undergraduate, partly imaginative ones reading. C.S. Lewis has a lovely comment about his own conversion where he says, I suppose in a way my imagination was baptised before I was, and then the rest of me just took a little longer to catch up. So I very much experienced a kind of baptism of the imagination when I came up to Cambridge in the late 70s and had free run of the libraries just to read poetry, and call it work and do an English degree. But I also had some quite heart-stopping moments of, as it were, awareness of a divine presence, which I felt I couldn't ignore. So those things combined for me in a return to Christian faith in my final year as an undergraduate. But it was not a faith that in any sense thought I had now got God enclosed in a small box. Although I believed that the best account I could ever find of God was the God I met in Jesus Christ. The God I met in Jesus Christ seemed to me to be a God who was passionately interested in the whole world and loved it. And particularly, I'm a bit of a mystic. So the St. John's Gospel, you know, they're kind of the word that sustains everything in being. And, you know, that idea that underpinning all the phenomena is this word, this sort of meaning. In the end, the poet who really helped me out here was Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who asks us to interpret the whole cosmos as essentially a poem that's being read to us. And says, we don't just perceive it, you know, you don't get a poem by measuring the letters and doing the chemical composition of the paper, you know. You can do that, it's all very true, and you can call it science, but it's not, it's a poem. Let it say something to you. And that's, so my faith, I hope, has been both mind and heart expanding rather than mind and heart closing. As I know, sometimes faith is perceived by people to be this ever narrowing thing. In some forms of religiosity it is, But that's not been my experience.
And at what stage did you think this is a vocation? Because it's very well, you know, discovering you have a faith. Mm. But at what stage did you think, actually, this is what I want to do?
Yeah. Well, I never thought it was a vocation, partly because I looked around at the vicars I could see and the kind of cliched ideas of vicars on TV, you know, the kind of have some tea vicar. And by that time, you know, I had fairly long hair and I was riding a motorcycle and beginning to play in bands, and I couldn't see anybody that looked like me there. So, and I was passionate about poetry, so I kind of didn't. But then I decided that although I had not followed on beyond my university degrees, that I was going to have a go at a PhD just to, because I'd discovered John Donne in a big way, the poetry and prose of John Donne. And then I suddenly began to realise, wait a minute, this passionate love poet was not only a priest in the Church of England, he was a Dean of St. Paul's. And then I saw that George Herbert, you know, another poet I deeply admired, who I felt had a very honest approach to the ups and downs of faith. You know, he wasn't just towing anybody's party line. Oh, wait a minute, he's a priest in the Church of England. You know, and then you see it's the Catholic Church run, you know, Gerard Manley Hopkins. So I just began to, it began to dawn on me that there might be somewhere, you know, if God was calling me to do this, that perhaps the Church of England might still be big or broad enough to squeeze somebody who was less of the normal idea of a vicar. And
so when were you ordained? What year?
I was ordained in 1990. Yeah, so I was born in 57. I was ordained in 1990 in Ely Cathedral. I spent my whole time in Ely Diocese. You know, I've been a vicar in Hartford and Huntingdon, and you know, chaplain at Anglia Ruskin as it is now, as well as at Girton. So I've kind of been in and around. I've never quite escaped Cambridge's gravitational pull.
Oh, well, we'll come back to that. We'll come back to why you haven't escaped the gravity of Cambridge. But we'll listen to some young contributions now. Last year, Rock Road Library ran the Location as Inspiration writing competition aimed at children and young people under the age of 16. The idea was to write a short story or a poem about a place in Cambridge, and more than 200 submissions were received. The judges were writers Adele Jones and Julian Sedgwick, and we're going to hear a winner and a runner-up now. We'll start with The Day Trip by David Stickland, which was a winner in the 7 to 11 year old category, and that will be followed by The Mill Road Winter Fair by Neelam Solanki, who was a runner-up in the 12 to 16 year old category. But as I say, we'll kick off with The Day Trip.
Ethan Wright looked out of the window of his tiny student's room in St. John's College at the piles of floating debris drifting about where once had been houses and parks. He felt sad that he had never got to see Cambridge when it was a proper city, with proper roads and guided busways and a railway that linked it to all the other cities. It was many years since global warming had left the whole of Cambridge underwater, but not the colleges. The colleges were filled with clever and inventive engineers, like he was training to be, who had come up with the perfect way to save them all, by placing them on stilts. Now the centre of Cambridge was nothing but a collection of beautiful ornate buildings on giant marble pillars connected by sturdy wooden bridges and walkways. In between were the greeny blue waters of the city centre, on which 100 different types of boat bashed and crashed their way around. A half-sunken bridge crossed what used to be the River Cam, but was now just part of the Wicken Sea. Off to one side was the huge Parker's Barge, where people still played ball games until their balls bounced over the side into the water, where they had to be rescued before they floated out to sea. It was the first day of May. This meant the Cambridge Fair was starting, and Ethan had planned to go out to Wandlebury Island to spend the afternoon strolling round the stalls selling delicious food, fabrics of every imaginable colour, and hundreds of old things salvaged from all the houses which were now underwater. But first, he popped down to Market Square, where the brightly painted shop boats were all tied up together in a large cluster, so he could buy some tasty food for his picnic. In the market, there were trinket stores, collectible stores, clothes shops, general stores, and all sorts of stalls selling food. He found some fresh salmon eels, a little golden loaf of bread, and even an apple from the Grantchester water orchard. When he was ready, he put his small toolbox, which he always carried around with him, into one of the college punts, climbed in and set off for the distant island. He rowed his way past the few apartment buildings and office blocks that still poked up above the water. In the clear water below him, he could see divers exploring and salvaging, searching for anything interesting or valuable still left inside. Wonderboy Island was full of people, thousands of people. Acrobats and jugglers and musicians and face painters passed on all sides. A man with a giant eagle was doing tricks, and another, on stilts, was dressed up as a tree. Stallholders sold popcorn and fish burgers and squid on a stick. There was a play area for the children with some small trees to climb and some water bumper carts down by the beach. But it was the stall selling salvage that Ethan was interested in. He wandered up and down the aisles, looking at the water-stained books, odd bits of furniture, and useless electrical appliances like old toasters and kettles and wireless modems. He was looking for a present to buy himself to celebrate the fair, and he wanted to be something really special. But none of the books were interesting enough, and none of the electrical goods were useful enough. Then he saw a stall selling the perfect thing. A plant. A leafy red and green coleus. He looked at the plant longingly and was sad that it was too expensive for him. There were lots of plants on the stall, but most of them were too small or too big or too ugly. But the coleus was just right. It was the perfect colour, it was the perfect size, and Ethan knew exactly where he would have put it. "You have some wonderful plants," Ethan said to the man on the stall. "Where did you get them?"
"We grow them here," the man replied. "In the botanic gardens. When the old botanic gardens drowned, we saved thousands of seeds and replanted everything here on Wandlebury Island. We sell the plants to make money so we can buy things we need and keep them safe and help them grow. We have a special machine that makes them grow super fast, but it's broken and we need to buy a new one."
"What's wrong with it?" Ethan asked.
"I don't know," the man said. "I'm not an engineer."
"I am," Ethan said. "Maybe I could fix it for you."
"Well, if you could, that would be fantastically, amazingly brilliant."
The man led Ethan through a wondrous collection of plants, including red bamboo, some cherry blossoms, and a blackcurrant tree with autumn colours that Ethan thought was particularly nice. Then Ethan saw a big metal box full of wires and pulleys and gears. He examined it and saw that part of it had overheated and started to melt. He took out his tools and began to fix the machine. He found a box of spare parts and he used them to make an internal fan for the machine so it would stay cool and not overheat anymore.
"That's fantastically, amazingly brilliant," the man said when Ethan had finished. "Now our plants can grow like they used to. I need to pay you for the work. We haven't got very much money, but I know just the thing to give you instead."
Later that afternoon, Ethan rode all the way back to St. John's College. He went up to his room and ate cold squid on a stick. As he watched the sunset through the window and admired the beautiful coleus that the man at the plant stall had given him that was now placed on his windowsill, he wondered what life had been like before the flood.
"Put your coat and gloves on and hold my hand tight. Then we can open the door and step into the light. The snow-dusted trees, no more busy bees, the frosted-up cars all wearing wigs of white. Small pink welly boots walking down the pavement, running so fast to get to the fair. Wearing them as an eager little girl, snowflakes getting tangled up in her brown knotted hair. She leaps onto the road, embracing the happy life. Children delightfully squealing, a husband laughing with his wife. Mill Road, once quiet and bare, is adorned in lights and sparkles, a real festive flair. A tsunami of people rolling down the street, bursting through and tackling the bridge or slowing down to take a seat. The smells and flavours, the sweets and spices, ribbon-wrapped bonbons and bowls of different rices, sugar, cinnamon, nutmeg and clove, people huddling round a firelighted stove. So many different foods, Indian or Thai, French tarts and Spanish churros. Which will you try? Take a sip of that hot chocolate and feel the warmth blossom in you, all into your gut and all the way down to the toes in your shoe. Listen to the music, that rhythmic beat of the drums, people dancing so wildly, singing at the top of their lungs. Now look at your watch. It's already 4. It's time to leave. The shops are closing their doors. I know you want to stay. I know it's not fair. Just remember this day when you went to the Mill Road Winter Fair.
And the Mill Road Winter Fair by Neelam Solanki was read by Sandra Burney. And before that, The Day Trip by David Stickland was read by James Steadman. You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. My studio guest today is poet Malcolm Guite. Malcolm, it's lovely to hear young writing, isn't it? The energy.
Really, yes, it's great. Both of them I thought were very good. But I was very struck certainly by the sort of new perspective on Cambridge, you know, flooded Cambridge. And that was very good. Wandlebury as an island. It was very well thought through.
Now, you write poetry. Have you ever written short stories or not tempted by a novel?
I'm tempted by a novel at the moment. I mean, I've mainly written poetry, but I'm just to try it out, just to see how it might be. I'm having a go at a novel at the moment.
Oh, are you?
Which
okay.
is very... I was struck that the theme, you know, of that competition was particular places. I think places are really important for writing. So my novel is going to be, if I get beyond where I am with it, is set in a particular place in a little church not far from Cambridge in the village of Hadstock. It's, you know, happens to be a very, very ancient thing. It's a kind of time-shifting novel. But I'm always inspired by a place. In my book, The Singing Bowl, there's the first section of poetry is called Local Habitations. And that's a sort of, it's an allusion to one like the best definition of how poetry works ever, which needless to say is by Shakespeare, but it's where he describes the poet writing. And he says, the poet's eye in a fine frenzy rolling doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven. And as imagination bodies forth the form of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. And that seems to be the very art of it. You know, you could be airy-fairy and going off in the world of abstractions forever and nobody would be any the wiser. But as soon as it's, you know, this little girl in her pink welly boots pulling at a hand, you know, because she wants to get to the winter fair, or, you know, that particular plant that I want on my windowsill, suddenly all those...
The concreteness, the specificity
it down,
of it,
you know,
yes.
So, yeah.
Well, we're going to hear your second choice of music now, which is Waterboys. This is one of my favourite tracks as well. Hole of the Moon. Why this one?
Well, I love the Waterboys, I have to say. I think Mike Scott is a real poet, without question, and I love the kind of exuberance and energy and unexpectedness of their music. This is a particular one for me, not only because I love it, I love the moon and so on, but I've just finished writing this sort of fairly big book on... It's both about Samuel Taylor Coleridge as a his life story, but it's about the Rime of the Ancient Mariner and how, in a way, although he wrote it young, it kind of tracked his life and how it's relevant for us. And as you may remember, the moving moon went up the sky and nowhere did abide, you know, softly she was going up and a star or two beside.
Your memory for quotes is astonishing. Very impressive.
I get that from my mother, you know, just because. So the moon is really important, and in fact the mariner, it's only when the mariner looks again at things in moonlight and he sees all these water snakes that he was previously going, slimy, horrible. You know, he just blesses them and he sees they're beautiful. And then the albatross falls off and he can pray. So I think moonlight was particularly magical and transformative for Coleridge. And it has been so for me. So this song says it all.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark, and our studio guest on Bookmark today is the poet Malcolm Guite. And Malcolm, you're going to read some of your poetry now.
Yes, since I wasn't sure what to read, but inspired by those two young competitors whose work we've already heard, since they were really writing about inspiring places or moments in and around Cambridge. I think I'll read you this one, which is called Out in the Elements, Grantchester. And it's about a walk from Cambridge to Grantchester, the one that I'm sure lots of people have done. But this is early spring and sort of almost all four seasons. It also plays with the traditional four elements, the earth, air, water and fire. So Out in the Elements. I crunch the gravel on my ravelled walks and clabber with my boots in the wet clay. For I myself am clay that breathes and talks, articulated earth. I move and pray, alive at once to walk and be the way. The root beneath, the branch above the tree, these hedges, bright with blossom, white with may, everything concentrates, awaits in me the coming of the one who sets creation free. Earth opens now to sudden drumming rains, the raised and falling waters of the sea, whose tidal pull and play is in my veins, spreading and spilling, filling, flowing free, whose ebb and flow is still at work in me and in the wombing pulse of play and work, when heartbeats pushed in waves of empathy till waters broke and bore me from the dark and found this foundered shore and took me from the ark. As rain recedes, I pause to fill my pipe and kindle fire that flickers into light and lights the leaf all curled and cured and ripe within a burst-starred bowl. How fierce and bright it glows against the cold, and I delight in taste and fragrance, watching wisps of grey and graceful smoke in their brief flight. As sun breaks from the clouds and lights my way, I feel the fire that makes the light that makes the day. Now, air is all astir. In breaks and blasts, the last grey rags of cloud are blown aside. The hedgerows hush and rustle in the gusts as clean winds whistle round me. Far and wide, bent grasses and frail flowers lean aside. I breathe the world in with this brimming breeze that tugs at me and eddies at my side, quickens and flickers through the tangled trees and breathes me back to life and brings me to my knees. Akin to every creature, I will learn from each and all the meaning of my birth. I love the dust to which I will return, the subtle substance of my mother earth. From water born, by fire fathered forth, an index and epitome of nature, I sum and summon all the world is worth, and breathing now his elemental air, I find the one within, without, and everywhere.
That was lovely. Thank you. I shall never do that walk. I feel quite the same about it. Beautiful. That wasn't a sonnet, but you are particularly fond
of sonnets.
Yeah,
that's my thing. Yeah. So I was going to start with a sonnet, but it was just because of the
other
poems.
Inspired by this.
Yeah. I love the sonnet form. For the very practical reason that you know when you're going to stop before you start. You know, you can see the end in view. It kind of concentrates the mind. Indeed, concentration, I think, is what the sonnet's all about. You know, you can see the whole thing on a piece, on the one sheet. And it requires you to have something to say that's pertinent. And the way the sonnet works, you know, you can break it into an eight and a six, or you can do like three fours and a two. It fits very well with certain ways of structuring your thought, you know, saying something and then thinking, oh, no, maybe I'll look at the other side of it and saying that. You know, Shakespeare does that a lot in the sonnets where he'll say one thing and then he'll say another and then he'll try and bring them together. Or sometimes you know there's going to be what the old sonneteers called a volta or a turn at some point. A sonnet's meant to suddenly turn and reconfigure what you thought you knew. And sometimes you can see Shakespeare like painting himself into a really narrow corner, you know. Like, I think it's maybe the one that begins when in despite with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone beweep my outcast state. And he goes on line after line about how bad things, it's just like, this is terrible. And you're thinking, wait a minute, you know, is this supposed to be a love sonnet? Are we going to get any good news? And he's got all the way down to line 12. And it's like, you've only got two lines to get out of this. What are you going to do? And it just got worse and worse. And then he just goes, but If the while I think on thee, dear friend, all losses are restored and sorrows end. And it's great, you know, and he ends the sonnet with the word end. Now, in order to have that wonderful effect of the way he turns it all around at the end, you kind of need to know before you started when the end is going to be, and you have to watch him. You know, it's like a game of football. You can't go offside, you know, or tennis. You know, the boundary lines are the very thing that concentrates the play. And I need that, I find, as a writer.
And is there something about poetry that offers you the chance to explore, because you do explore spiritual issues.
I do, yeah.
Rather than, I mean, I know you're working on a novel, yeah. But it's interesting that you turn to poetry.
And poetry is my prime thing. I mean, I'm a real baby beginner at the novel, whereas I've done poetry for a long time, so I kind of feel more capable of the material. Yes, it does. I find that poetry, one of my favourite poets spiritually is George Herbert. And people sometimes think, oh, George Herbert, Anglican priest poet, this must be nothing but sweet piety. But of course it isn't. One of the things that Herbert does within the frame of his faith, within the frame of his spirituality, and particularly in his poetry, is to express his difficulties. So perhaps his single most famous poem, Love, which could be interpreted as a kind of human love match, but is also a divine one, you know, that famously begins, "Love bade me welcome," which sounds lovely, and you could stick that on the front of a church, couldn't you? But it goes on, "Love bade me welcome, but my soul drew back, guilty of dust and sin. You know, quick-eyed love, observing me grow slack from my first entrance in, drew nearer to me, sweetly questioning if I like." And what you then get is this almost courteous minuet between the beckoner and the refuser. And the refuser really putting his stuff on the table. And I found that freedom in poetry to be both and rather than either or. And to embrace paradox and contradiction, which always looks a bit awkward in cold prose, but in poetry you go, okay, fair enough, you know. I'm reading a poem. I'm willing to hold those things in balance. I mean, I wonder if maybe I could illustrate that.
Yes.
With a, I mean, I just recently wrote my book Parable and Paradox is a series of poems about the sayings of Jesus. And the point about the poems is not to just go, here's what he said, isn't it lovely? But to go, oh my goodness, what do I do with that? Like, really? And so I'm wrestling with it. So I've got a series of sonnets. I'll just read one of them just to give you the tone. It's called Five Dialogues on the Two Great Commandments. So famously, Jesus is asked, what's the greatest commandment? And he says, you know, the first is to love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind and all your strength. And the second is like, love your neighbour as yourself. And we trot this out, you know, literally every Sunday morning. And I just thought, just those categories like heart, what exactly, you know, really? All my heart, not just the good bits? So I'll just read you my first response, please. With all your heart. All these sonnets have a what's called an octet and a sestet. So you've got an eight and a six. And in each of these, in my eight, I'm going, you must be joking. And then I'm waiting for the reply. And I wouldn't get the reply if I didn't ask the question. So here we go, with all your heart. One, with all your heart. With all my heart. You know my heart too well. It's Yeats's Rag and Bone Shop. Will it do to start my loving in that little hell, closed on itself and still excluding you? Could I not offer you some empty room, some small apartment full of light and air, some portion of my life above the gloom, but not this pit of pride, not this despair? Only your heart will do. Let me begin to break the ground and plant a seed that grows up through the closing darkness of your sin till your unsightly roots bring forth my rose. For I have learned to make the broken true, since my heart too was broken once for you.
Well, Wow, thank you very much for that. We will we'll hear some more from young people now, just at the beginning of their journey. So we're going back to the location as inspiration, Rock Road Library Writing Competition. Two more outstanding entries for you to listen to. The Night at King's College Chapel by Alexandra Tullett was a winner in the 7 to 11-year-old category, and An Echo of Life by Melissa Wendt was a runner-up in the 12 to 16-year-old category. We'll start with The Night at King's College Chapel by Alexandra Tullett.
It was coming up to the end of practice and I was so exhausted. I didn't think of the consequences that lay ahead of me. I crept down from the seats and curled up on one of the pews. Somehow I'd fallen asleep. No one came. The chapel grew icy cold at night. My hands froze like solid icicles. I awoke with a start. It was the old wooden door slowly opening. I peered around with one eye and saw a man coming into the darkness of the chapel. I curled up into a ball. He spoke to me with a soft tone, calming me. "Be not afraid. I am the light." He wore a long white robe with the most amazing golden cloak, fastened with a jewel clasp around his chest. But strangely enough, he was barefooted, and I thought how cold his feet must have been. His face was pale and he had a beard. He looked lonely and as if he was looking for something. In his left hand he was holding a lantern which shone so brightly I could see him glancing at a figure on one of the stained glass windows. What was it? I needed to see more clearly, so I slowly stood up, my legs shaking. All of a sudden he turned to look at me and smiled. I needed to get out and I needed to get out now, so I ran as fast as I could, not looking back. I kept running, faster and faster, until all I could see was the faint outline of the chapel. Out of breath, I sat on the curb. I was freezing, but that wasn't the only thing I noticed. Different thoughts were swirling around my head. Who was he? What was he doing? What was he looking at? Why was he dressed like that? After a while, I stood up and started to slowly walk to my shared school dormitory. I live with Georgia and Holly. I wondered what they would be doing, as they thought I was coming home after choir. The streets were empty but filled with quiet echoes. I walked for 5 minutes before reaching my room. As I got closer to the door, I realised I'd left my coat in the chapel. I panicked as my keys were in one of the pockets. I thought Georgia and Holly would still be awake, so I pushed the door open. I walked up to my bed, but collapsed with exhaustion and fell asleep. The following morning, we were all eating breakfast at the dining table when Georgia started asking about choir the previous night. I whispered to myself, "Don't mention it." And to my surprise, no one said anything. It's like they both didn't even notice I was gone that night. That morning was quieter than usual. It was mostly because I was confused. I thought I'd seen this man before. I then remembered my coat. I got my jumper on, my boots and scarf, and plodded downstairs to the school shed. I found my old, green, rusty bike and set off to the chapel. As I was cycling, all I could think about was the lonely stare on the man's face last night. It was worrying. What if he needed to talk to me? What if I missed a vital bit of information? Well, he must work there, because how else would someone have the key to the door? He must still be around. Maybe he was the night caretaker. I finally arrived after what felt like a decade. The usual porter was on the door, ushering everyone who came in. I started to explain to him what had happened, how I got locked in, how I'd fallen asleep and left my coat, and I described the man I saw. The porter looked puzzled. "We don't have anyone who works here like that, and the chapel is all locked up at night." "That's him." In the corner of my eye, I saw a painting of the same man at a wooden door, holding the same lantern and barefoot. "But that's a painting of Jesus. You can't have seen Jesus," the porter spluttered. But I did. I know for sure I wasn't dreaming. I dashed inside, grabbed my coat, but laying on top was a wooden cross. This was getting way too real. I ran as fast as I could, not thinking there was King's Parade outside, or that BBC vans were coming to film us for our Christmas Eve. I ran straight into the road and I got run over. I'm now an angel watching everyone below. And now I know who this man was, telling me a message. My job now was to keep everyone safe. Maybe if I'd thought a bit harder. Life is precious. We should all cherish it.
Connecting our city. Cambridge 105.
A single flower lays in my hand. So small and round. A bud of yellow pollen enveloped in a sea of petals. Each one dazzling in its own individual way. The stalk, a lime green, struggling to support itself. It sits there, motionless, hopeless, lifeless, a mere carcass of its former self, just a shadow, just a memory. Isn't it strange how something so precious, so defenseless, can all be gone in just one heartbeat? A single tug from the ground, a tear of the stalk, like a child to paper, and gone, all gone. I remember the song of birds, a sweet, peaceful chirp in the early morning. They nested in the trees, trees so bushy and bursting with life. The scamper of squirrels, the gentle leap of a frog. Now just a fragment of my imagination, now just an echo. The flower falls from my hand, plummets to the hard concrete ground of Cambridge, what was once a home to luscious trees and beauty, bustling with wildlife and grace, has been replaced with something cheaper, something more efficient. Gigantic trees slowly changing into towers of corporate horror. Bikes to cars and planes slowly devouring the time we spend on this earth. No room left for nature. No room for that perfect little flower.
That was An Echo of Life by Melissa Went, read there by James Steadman. And before that, Night at King's College Chapel by Alexandra Tullett was read by Lindsay McCauley. Malcolm Guite, I'm afraid we're coming to the end of our time with you. It's been lovely talking to you. We'll hear your last choice of music in just a moment. But we're asking all our guests a new question for all our guests before you go. What book are you reading at the moment?
We've always got several on the go. I'm actually reading mostly at night Boswell's life of Samuel Johnson, of Dr. Johnson, which is great because you can just read a little bit and then leave it, and a little bit, and it's full of just wonderful stories and anecdotes. I like Johnson as a character. He's a larger than life character. He's incredibly grumpy, but also very, very funny on occasions and full of wisdom. So it's just another age and another time. So I'm reading that mainly for fun, and also trying to sort of occasionally rereading bits of my own book on Coleridge, because I'm doing quite a lot of sort of kind of interviews and comments and reviews, because that's just come out. So that's a bit weird, actually. You say, did I write that?
Going back over it. Well, our next show, we will be talking to playwright Sean Lang. We'll hear more winning entries from the Rock Road Library Writing Competition, and also hear from writer and academic Helen Marshall about the new Centre for Science Fiction and Fantasy, which has just been launched at Anglia Ruskin University. So your last choice of music, Malcolm, briefly, it's Thea Gilmore. So brief, this girl is taking bets. Why this one?
She was a bit of a discovery for me. I'd never heard of her. She's not on a main label. She was on a free CD of other people singing Dylan songs, and she sang I Dreamed I Saw St. Augustine brilliantly. I loved it so much I went and got her album. And I realised that she's a fine songwriter in her own right, and a bit of a female Dylan. This song I particularly love. It's a bit like Dylan's Subterranean Homesick Blues, you know, that Johnny's in the basement mixing up the medicine, with the wonderful strings of word sounds. But it's a very feisty girl saying, don't mess with me. And she's just got great images, like she's the far end of the graveyard up where the nettles grow, or, you know, does it where she talks about poetry.